In the previous lesson, we introduced hadith as records of the sayings and deeds of the prophet, tens of thousands of reminiscences by his companions, his wives, and these really show us the kind of person Muhammad was and the sorts of things that he taught. We introduced the concept of hadith, and then we looked at the life of Muhammad, the personal life. Now we move into the next section, which is the supernatural. These are things that I've gleaned from a hadith. And whereas the Quran itself is really short on miracles, the hadith is not at all. And because some of the things I'll share here are, let's say they would fall into the category of the supernatural or the paranormal or the highly unusual, I put them all together under the heading supernatural. Old Testament. In the hadith, we read that Adam, as in the first human, was 60 cubits tall. 60 cubits, like more than 100 feet tall. And that mankind's height has been shrinking ever since. Now, I know you might say, oh, did he really say that? Remember, the hadith of Bukhari, like the hadith of Muslim, are those that have been, they've gone past the difficult vetting process. You could find some things that would be very easy to dismiss in some of the other collections. But this has credence. And even today, there are many Muslims who believe that there were giants in the past and would take this kind of passage quite literally. We read also that Moses was bathing and his clothes are stolen. Stolen by a stone. A stone. And so Moses has to chase the stone, and the stone is retreating with his clothes, and Allah was trying to make it clear to his detractors that Moses had been properly circumcised. So if he didn't have his clothes off, it wouldn't be obvious. So the miracle really has to do with Moses' authority and, you know, being actually circumcised. But what is going on? A stone stealing Moses' clothes? I already mentioned Muhammad's face that was glowing after the pattern of Moses, Exodus 34. Something that seems to have the hue of the supernatural. I also read in volume 4 of the hadith that Israelites were lost in the desert. So think of the desert years, the desert wanderings. But a group of Israelites were lost in the desert and they were turned into rats. How about supernatural things that connect with the New Testament? I have the sense sometimes that Muhammad was competing with Jesus. For example, he has control over the weather. You know, he can make things happen. On the other hand, many religious figures have claimed such, or their followers have attributed these powers to them. I think of the Tibetan lamas, who I learned about in graduate school. The Tibetan lamas who would launch hailstorms with their fingertips. Muhammad performs a miracle of the multiplication of water. So think of Jesus multiplying the wine in John 2. This is multiplication of water. Basically, he's doing his ablutions. And before prayer, before worship, you need to go through the appropriate washings. And he has a pot of water, which would be, I guess it's fine if one person uses it. But 80 persons used it. The water kept replacing itself, and so out of a single pot, 80 people were able to make ablutions. I saw that hadith at least 3 times in the first 4 volumes of Bukhari. Another miracle, the miracle of the dates. Similarly, food is needed, but it is multiplied through the grace of Muhammad. He heals a man who has eye trouble by spittle. Now, in the only kind of gross miracle, the New Testament, Jesus spits on the ground and with the dirt and his saliva makes a paste which he applies to the eyes of the blind man, John chapter 9. And then the blind man goes and sees. Now, this is a little bit different because for Muhammad, the man had some eye trouble. I don't I didn't read that he was completely blind. But Muhammad uses spit and heals the man. And that's the kind of detail that makes me wonder, okay, I'm sure he's heard the story of the blind man being healed. That was well known. That happened almost 600 years before the death of Muhammad. Let's say Jesus did that miracle in 29 AD, okay? And Muhammad, this is, who knows when this is, 625 AD, say, something like that. It's almost six centuries this story has been circulating. I think he's competing. And that would also explain why we read that Muhammad has the right to intercede for us on the day of judgment. Now, Christians say that only Jesus intercedes. Well, the Spirit intercedes. Of course, it's all by the Spirit. But Jesus, Hebrews 7:25, intercedes. But here we see Muhammad has the right to intercede. So you may be noticing that some things are attributed to Muhammad that are on a grand scale, but you don't find them in the Quran, because there are a number of Muslim beliefs that are not in the Quran. You have to go to the traditions. Well, think about modern Christianity, all the denominations, all the divisions. Theoretically, you should be able to ask any church leader of any denomination, why do you do this? Or why do you say that? And he'd have a scripture for it. But the truth is, a lot of things don't have that much to do with the scripture. They're matters of what is practical, or decisions that were made in councils in centuries past. People may be devoted to the writings of certain holy men or women. So all religions tend to do this. They tend to wander away from their origins. Now, there are some minor miracles that Muhammad does. And again, in the notes that accompany the podcast, you can track these down. We see him overcoming a demon while at prayer. You know, he's at the mosque and he's attacked by a demon, and it's like he throttles the demon and wants to attach it to a pillar. You know, there's this struggle going on. But there are other more impressive claims. You've probably heard of the Muhammad splitting the moon into two parts. Many Muslims say that is the meaning of Surah 54 in the Quran. But this is mentioned in the Hadith. And some Muslims take it literally. Others spiritualize it. Some take it so literally that they fell for a hoax. The hoax was that when the moon was being explored, NASA discovered a crack that ran through the moon and showed that it had been in two parts. Well, this is like the biblical hoax of the missing day of Joshua. Scientists at NASA are stumped because things don't add up. They realize, hey, we're missing a day in the calendar. We're off chronologically. And then this guy pulls out his Bible from his desk drawer and says, wait a minute, look over here in Joshua 10, the missing day. And this was a hoax, but because it seems like it supports the Bible, it was by many uncritically accepted, and it still goes around in the emails which you're supposed to forward to all your friends, but don't do it. In other words, it's not just Christians, Muslims, it's any human can fall and be a dummy, and just, you know, we want to believe, and so we are uncritical about the evidence. Or maybe you've heard that when Muhammad was born, the first thing he did was to reach down and grab some dust in his hand, which he threw up as he looked heavenwards and proclaimed, Allahu Akbar, you know, God, He is great. And this is why Muslims whisper these words into the baby's ears. The first thing the baby should hear is that Allah, He is great. Allahu Akbar. In the Hadith, I read about a talking cow and a talking wolf. You might say, but do they really believe it? Or is it more like Aesop's fables, you know, just a folk tale? But actually, the Hadith is not just a story, the genre of which would be open to discussion. What's being discussed is whether the animals had actually been talking, and the decision is that yes, they had. So the interpretation is actually given to us. Yes, a talking cow and a talking wolf. Muhammad saw the greatest of the signs of the Lord. And the greatest of the signs was an enormous green carpet opened all over the horizon of the sky. That, to him, was a beautiful sign. Probably the most famous miraculous activity of Muhammad, some Muslims take it literally, others think it's more of a vision, was his night journey. He was on his mount, whose name was Barak, and he takes off for heaven. They say from the Dome of the Rock, he was, you know, the foundation stone. He was in Jerusalem, and he goes up the various levels of heaven. It's called the Mihraj. I think we're all familiar with the word Mihraj. Think of the man in the desert who sees the water, or he thinks he does. So is it a Mihraj? Is it literally true or not? Let me tell you what Muhammad saw. As he was going to Allah, he saw Moses, who was a tall, brown, curly-haired man. Well, brown, okay. I mean, I don't know how brown the Israelites were. They were Asians. They were certainly dark-skinned, much darker than Europeans or white Americans, but certainly not as dark as Sudanese or black Africans. But tall, brown, and curly-haired. Interesting. Then he sees Jesus. And Jesus has light skin. He's fair-skinned, a man of pinkish complexion and lank hair. His hair is just kind of hanging there. Sounds like those Sunday school pictures of Jesus, doesn't it? I think for a good reason, and we'll come back to that later. Muhammad claims that the revelations he received, you know, we know that he received many in a cave where he used to go to be alone, but when he was at home in the camp, he says he got revelations only on the bed of Aisha, his favorite wife. And, you know, they took it in turns. He was with all of his wives, but only on her bed. Or did she make that up, I wonder? There was a bit of a power struggle about three caliphs after Muhammad, and Aisha was still alive. Who knows? It's beyond historical verification. But if the hadith is right, then he gets these messages from heaven only when he is on her bed at night. This comes, you know, when he would be sleeping. Allah is speaking to him. The Quran has no unambiguous miraculous claims. And that's why many Muslims I've met say that the Quran itself is the miracle. It's the only miracle. Many Muslims, and quite likely those you're likely to meet, are westernized. And some are actually not only westernized, they're scandalized. They're scandalized by some embarrassing parts of the Quran. You know, like the very masculine heaven or the wife beating. And they're scandalized, and they'll say, no, there are no miracles in the Quran, but the Quran itself is a miracle. Or one religious group I met who were trying to convert me to Islam said that the only miracle is mathematical, and the entire Quran is based around the number 19. And then they produce all these coincidences based on the numbers of the surah and the ayat, you know, the chapters and verses of the Quran, which you could do that, by the way, with any book. You know, set the parameters right, let the computer run with verse numbers and chapter numbers, and you can prove about anything you want to. But why would they do that? Because there are no unambiguous miracle claims in the Quran. But wonders ascribed to Muhammad increased outside and after the Quran, just as miracles were attributed to the Buddha. You know, after the Buddha died, and remember, the Buddha didn't even believe in God. There are all these miracle stories, including, like in the Yataka tales, the Buddha would be talking when he was born and doing miracles as a child. Similar stories of Jesus in the 2nd and 3rd century apocryphal Gospels. You know, Jesus is talking in the cradle. That's a story that Muhammad heard and passed on himself. So we shouldn't be surprised that there's this kind of development in Islam. But it doesn't mean we have to accept it. So, we've looked at the life of Muhammad, We've looked at the supernatural. Now let's talk about reverence. We return to the man, and I think this is important. His followers wanted to do everything the way Muhammad did it. The way Muhammad prayed. The way Muhammad cleansed himself in preparation for prayer. Even things like, you know, how would Muhammad spit or even go to the toilet? The competition for access to this charismatic figure was intense. And you'll read this. This is in volume one of Bukhari, but you'll read it in more than one place. Muhammad would be washing out his mouth, you know, spitting the water out. This is in the ablutions. You clean your nose, you clean your mouth. And as the water was falling, the companions would all be competing. They'd be trying to get the water that had been in Muhammad's mouth. Or they would rub his spittle on their face and skin. They would use the remaining ablution water themselves. And when they approached Muhammad, they would lower their voices. And they wouldn't look at him, or at least they wouldn't look constantly at him out of respect. They would avert their eyes. Why would they treat him with such reverence? Because we read, a single hair on Muhammad's head is worth more than the entire world. Would you feel the same way about Jesus Christ? I know Jesus said, the hairs of our head are numbered. But does that mean that they're precious? We may think that if Jesus were here, yes, he would be precious, his face, his hands, and I want to see them one day. I want to be in his embrace. And okay, I understand that. I'm asking you this. In biblical thought, would we say that the hair of Jesus, a single hair, is more precious than the entire world? Now, whether it's true or not, I would argue that that's not such a sentiment is not consistent with biblical usage. And yet Muhammad is called Savior of the world. Muslims will call him Lord of the universe. They will frequently claim that he is sinless, even though the Quran denies that, as does the Hadith. Certainly, he was never regarded as Lord, at least not officially. This is a stark contrast to Christ, who accepted worship in his lifetime. Walking as Jesus walked, 1 John 2:6, involves a different kind of imitation, a different kind of reverence. It doesn't mean that we have to wear the kind of sandals that Jesus wore, or walk on water, or walk on the roads of Galilee. To walk as Jesus walked has to do with our relationship to God and others, and why we live, what makes us get up in the morning. So imitation, biblical imitation, even when Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ, it's not a slavish imitation of the little things that Jesus used to do. We don't even know what Jesus looked like. And I think that's good. Because if we read that Jesus was this height, those of us who are that exact height would be so proud. And others would feel depressed because, I wasn't as tall as Christ. Or we would be taller than Jesus and then we'd think that, I'm the man. Or look at me, I have the correct hair color. Or he doesn't want us to focus on the external, but on the internal, on the heart. When Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11:1, follow me as I follow Christ, he's specifically talking about giving up our rights. Being willing to be wronged, being sensitive to our brothers and sisters. And so walking as Jesus walked involves a different sort of imitation. Jesus was insulted, for example. He was insulted, but he didn't lash back. Muhammad, I cannot say the same for him. In the section on violence, I will substantiate it. It's very sad. And I'm sure it's sad to very Muslims. Sad to them that when Muhammad is insulted, when people take offense, there can be extreme consequences. Shouting, and maybe rioting. People may be imprisoned or even executed. And even right now, in several nations, there are laws, and other nations, they're considering enacting laws that make it criminal to insult the prophet and carry a capital penalty. If it's felt that you have insulted Muhammad, then you must be executed. Okay, I'm all for respect. The Bible teaches we should respect everyone. In fact, it says we should respect Nero. I mean, Peter and Paul say, and he was the emperor from 54 to 68, right? When many New Testament documents were being written. And they say we're supposed to give him proper respect. You might say, well, that's zero in his case. No. There was a kind of respect. And Christians were used to being disrespected. But fighting back and standing on our rights and being all huffy and offended, something's wrong with that. And I think it has very much to do with how people related to Jesus in his time compared to how people related to Muhammad or how he expected them to relate to him in his time. Does that make sense? So that's my third Roman numeral. That's reverence. Fourth, I want to talk about Muslim teachings and practices. In the book I wrote with my former Muslim friend, we cover all the basic teachings of Islam, and we have virtually nothing in there about the Hadith. That would have made quite a long book, I guess. So consider this to be material that will complement what you've learned. The Hadith says there should be no rules beyond the Book of Allah. The Book of Allah being the Quran. And yet, with a touch of irony, I think, the Hadith are filled with rules. They're chock full of rules. Rules that are outside the Quran. Rules that go beyond what you would conclude by simply reading the scriptures. Now, I know a Muslim could say, well, the principle of abrogation, if you don't know what that is, in a Quran 2, verse 100, it says that from time to time, a verse will be abrogated. It'll either be canceled, nullified, or replaced by something better, which it sounds like a convenient and somewhat self-serving doctrine. So I guess you could extend it and say, well, the Hadith could abrogate the Quran. I've never heard a Muslim say that. But, sometimes the things we say and the things we do don't match up very well. Think of Jesus' time. The Pharisees had extra rules. The idea that we need to put up a hedge around the law lest we break a command, even by accident, it's important to create extra rules so we won't even be close. Well, let's say you're living in New York and you're a Christian and she's a Christian and you want to go out, and so you think, let's double date, or let's get her back by midnight. Now, that's probably very good wisdom in there, right? You're both going to church the next day, I presume. Get her back by midnight. But it's when we make laws and we say, well, if you get back after midnight, that's a sin. Or if you're alone for 5 minutes, that's a sin. It's a sin because it could lead to a sin. Well, the sin is one thing. A condition that could lead to a sin is a separate thing. And we confuse the two, and that is a kind of legalism. And Christians are just as guilty of that as Muslims. And it's not surprising that in Islam there are many schools of jurisprudence. The law schools don't agree on all the laws, but that's not really my point. It's that we find schools of jurisprudence or schools of thought with various informal means of enforcing rules. We find them in every religion, or most religions. So, what goes beyond the Quran? And I'm referring to some of the basic teachings of the Quran in no particular order, just the order I put it for this presentation. Let's talk about fasting. One of the basic teachings of Islam is that you're supposed to fast during the month of Ramadan. You could have a light meal before sunrise, but no food and even no water in the daylight hours. That's rough, particularly if it's a hot month. And I know it rotates a bit because of the lunar calendar, but it's pretty rough. And if you've been to the Arabian Peninsula, you know how hot that is. So you'd have a light meal before sunrise, but then nothing until after sunset. And then you have a feast. So Ramadan, it's a month of fasting. If you're like me, when you first heard of it, you thought, wow, they fast for a month. But actually, food sales in Ramadan are greater than they are at any other time in the Muslim calendar. So there's plenty of eating. Still, there's a kind of discipline that comes with fasting. As a Christian, I've often wondered. I did a podcast on fasting and prayer where I ponder this possibility. Are Christians fasting the same way? You know, were they just not eating in the daytime, but then they'd have a little bite in the evening? I don't know. Maybe there's part of me that, you know, my flesh that wants it to be that way. Anyway, the idea of fasting for a whole month is challenging. But it's not as hard as you think if you go by the strict rules. But when you go to the Hadith, it changes. Here's how. But before I explain that, I want to share one of the Hadith I found that I thought captured the spirit of this institution very well. Muhammad said that Allah said, every good deed of Adam's son is for him except fasting. Fasting is for me. Okay, so Allah is saying fasting is for him. And I shall reward for it. I shall reward the fasting person. Verily, the smell of the mouth of a fasting person is better to Allah than the smell of musk. Well, in the Hadith, you often read about musk. It's a good smell. And then I think of what my own mouth is like when I'm fasting, and I don't think that smells so sweet. But to Allah, the mouth of a fasting person, the smell of that mouth is better than the smell of musk. So it's highly valued. Muhammad, according to Aisha, his wife, fasted even more in the month following Ramadan. So he fasted, of course, in Ramadan, but the next month he fasted even more. And a few passages later, we read that Muhammad fasted half the days of the year. Like half of the year he was fasting. He told his followers not to fast continuously because some would fast for 24 hours. He would say, no, just do it in the daylight hours. In the evening you can eat. But Muhammad went against that himself. He would fast continuously. He would not take part in the, you know, the pre-sunrise meal or the evening feast. How could he do that? Well, he says that Allah gave him food and drink while he was asleep. I don't know what to make of that, but I'm just relaying to you what I've discovered. And maybe as you read the Hadith, you will figure it out more. He taught that there is a special gate into paradise for those who fast. So that's something to look forward to. And then I thought this was really good. It warns us not to get an attitude towards those who are not fasting. So you're fasting and knocking yourself out, and you realize someone else is over there having an ice cream sundae. Don't get an attitude. I thought that's great. That's, you know, because wouldn't that invalidate the righteousness of what we're doing if we're getting a bad attitude towards those who are not as righteous as we are? We'd be like the Pharisee of Luke 18, wouldn't we? Looking down on someone else. Let's move from fasting to prayer. Wake up. Wake up. Prayer is better than sleep. Prayer is better than sleep. The words of the call to prayer at dawn. The muezzin calling out from the tower. The first time I was ever in a Muslim nation, it was Malaysia actually. And the first morning I woke up and I spent a month there. I heard this amplified call to prayer. And at first I thought, oh, what is that? I'm tired. And then I thought, hey, they're cheating. I don't think in Muhammad's time they used, you know, they had electrical wires amplifying it. But anyway, I think it's kind of like the function of the church bell in medieval Europe. You ring the bell, you know, people weren't paying attention to the time, then they get with it. So there's a function. But what's the amazing thing? If you ever go to any of the large Muslim cities, like go to Jakarta or Cairo. I'm trying to think of some places I've been where you hear, because some, they're not all coordinated. Some mosques will have the call to prayer a few minutes before another one, or they may even have different opinions. You know, the different schools of thought have different prayer times. And so they'll be at the same time, or they'll overlap, and it's is it a euphony or a cacophony? I don't know. That depends on your perspective. The Hadith teach multiple times that we should pray five times a day. Well, the Quran, of course, doesn't say that. And the Imam I've spoke to agrees with me that you can only really find three times in the Quran. But it becomes five. And there are reasons for this, which you can discover in the Hadith. It's also taught that prayer cleanses sin away. So just as the Friday bath washes away sin, fasting, in a sense, helps atone, but prayer washes sins away. How should you pray? Well, we've mentioned several times the importance of ablutions. You've got to wash just the right way. You know, the hands, the feet, the face, and even in the nose. And this makes me think of Jesus. Remember, the Pharisees were all hung up. They were critical of Jesus' disciples because before they ate, they weren't washing their hands in the approved method. And Jesus had some very strong words for them. Now, of course, Jesus was quoting from Isaiah 29. I'm referring to Mark 7, of course. He was strong because of their hypocrisy. You know, God was on their lips, but not, you know, it was far from their hearts. And I'm not claiming, I don't even want to imply that Muslim ablutions are a way of being hypocritical or just going through the external motions. I'm only mentioning that Jesus was quite critical and dismissive of certain traditions and the Pharisees. And yet this is very emphasized in the Hadith. Hadith also say that you may not know for sure whether the water you are using is pure. Is it pure or not pure? And if you're unsure, it's okay to use dust or sand. You could just reach down and grab whatever you have and use that. Of course, with modern science, we know that all kinds of things live in the dust and the sand, but then all kinds of things live in the water too. So ancient thought was different, right? They had different understandings. Worshippers should avoid garlic. Now, I always find that to be a good rule. And often as I travel around the world, people say, we're going to have dinner and then you can speak, you know, at the meeting or at the university. And Douglas, what do you like to eat? Well, I like everything. But I will often say, no raw onions if I'm about to speak. Not heavy garlic if I'm going into the fellowship. To me, that's just sensitivity to others. But Muhammad really had a thing about garlic and onions too. That, you know, you shouldn't smell like that when you go to the mosque. When you pray, you should stand. Now, if you're physically able, it's more complicated than that. You stand, and then you go down, and you kneel. You make these prostrations. And Muhammad, when he was old, it says he wasn't able to do that. You know, he can only do it a little bit. So there is some flexibility. But standing is worth twice as much as seated prayer. So Muhammad said, if you sit when you pray, that's okay. But the prayer is doubly effective if you stand. Seating is only 50% as potent, and if you lie down, the prostrate prayer is only half as potent as a seated prayer, thus one quarter as powerful as standing prayer. Interestingly, you know, the early Christians, when they prayed, if we read the literature outside the Bible, even if you read the New Testament, and when we look at Christian art, we see that standing was the common position, perhaps the most common position, which is why Jesus said, when you stand praying and you realize you have something against your brother has something against you, you know, go back and deal with it. The assumption that we'd be standing, and I'm not here to tell you what position to be in. I'm just telling you how those three positions are ranked in the Hadith. Your shoulders must be covered by your garment. For whatever reason. If you pass wind, if you have flatulence, you have to redo your prayer. That invalidates your prayer. In fact, some hadith say that, you know, when you smell this and you've got all these men
My wife says, yeah, it's all these men standing up and doing all these motions and bending over. Yeah, eventually you can't help it, right? You know, a little, you know, comes out. Sorry to be coarse, but the hadith says, well, that's Satan. You know, Satan himself passes wind. And it says if you have flatulence, you have to redo your prayer. It doesn't count. Interesting, huh? Things we never talk about in church. You keep your head down in the presence of the imam. So the imam is the teacher and he directs things. And everyone's lined up in straight rows, not curved, but you keep your head down. And one reason in the hadith is that if you lift up your head, you may be turned into a donkey. At least that was a common fear. I don't know who said that, but that's there. Ask Muhammad. The rows must not be curved. They have to be at, you know, parallel, strictly parallel. I find that interesting because as a man who frequently organizes Christian meetings, I'm pretty eager to have the rows curve because then we see each other. It's more social, more fellowship. It's a fellowship aspect. But in the prayer, they need to be parallel. And, of course, face Mecca. Originally, they faced Jerusalem. But after the Jews of Yathrib or Medina rejected Muhammad, I think that was very painful to him. He changed the Qibla, the direction, from praying to Jerusalem, as Daniel did. Think of Daniel 6. To praying towards Mecca. So that's all in the hadith. Now, on the other hand, although we're told how to pray, there is some flexibility. Prayer times could be flexible. One of the amazing things, if you're too sleepy to pray, you know, you might pray the wrong thing. How do you know if you're, you know, maybe you're praying something evil? So Muhammad said, go back to sleep. Interesting. Whenever I've gone to a mosque, I've been required to remove my shoes. If you've been to a mosque, I'm sure the same. But in the hadith we read that sometimes Muhammad prayed with his shoes on. Sometimes there were acceptable delays for prayer. There were delays. So it's not as legalistic as you might think. If it's a really stormy day, and even as I'm recording this podcast here in my home in Georgia, I look out the window and the rain and the thunder, and I'm wondering, is the electricity going to go out? But when it's really nasty weather, Muhammad said, pray at home. And this is one that touched me. Whenever he heard a child crying, you know, this shows that women were in the prayers too. They may have been separated, but they were present. But out of sensitivity to the mother, then Muhammad would shorten the prayers. Now, in the hadith, the prayers are sometimes quite long and very proscribed. He would shorten the prayers if he heard a child crying. So I said, there are ways you're expected to pray, yet there's flexibility, but still they're dead serious. Muhammad would burn down the house of anyone who missed prayer. He would burn your house down. If you ignored three warnings to come and pray, he would have you executed. Now, of course, we rightly regard such compulsion in religion as evil. I think that's evil. They say there's no compulsion in religion. Well, that sounds like compulsion to me. At the same time, I am convicted by those words. You know, wake up. Prayer is better than sleep. You know, sometimes I think I should be more alert. I should get up. I want to read my Bible. I should have that attitude of how groggy I am. Get up, Douglas. Get up and pray. Of course, another basic Muslim teaching is almsgiving. It's usually about 1/40th of your income. 1/40th, 2.5%, though it varies from school to school. In the hadith we read that your alms can save others. You can give alms on behalf of somebody else, provided that they themselves would have given had they had the opportunity. If you hoard your wealth, bad things will happen. In fact, gruesome things may happen to you if you hoard. And if you refuse to pay, if you refuse to cough up the alms, then that constitutes apostasy. this is such an important regulation that if you refuse to give, you are considered an apostate, and therefore you are executed. Islam doesn't tax the poor heavily, and yet there's no welfare state. The poor are expected to work if they can. They're very poor, of course. They can receive gifts from those who care. And before, we heard about Muhammad giving the whole basket of dates to that poor man. Well, this will make sense of another hadith, which says that the poor must not beg. Begging is strictly forbidden in Islam. So if you're in a Muslim country and someone's begging, you know that that guy is going against his religion. On the other hand, there's nothing that stops us from giving alms and helping the poor. I think the assumption is that those who are poor will benefit from their brothers who care about them. What about the pilgrimage, the Hajj? Of course, it has to be performed at least once in your lifetime, providing health and finances allow. On the Hajj, in the Hadith, we read about the Kaaba, that ancient site of idolatry in Mecca, and kissing the black stone, which Muhammad did himself. He kissed the stone. We read that one may perform Hajj for another. If you can't go, someone can go for you. Women can go on the Hajj. After Muhammad's final Hajj, when he was too old to go, from that point on, he did not permit pagans. So infidels were excluded. I'm going to talk about just a couple other teachings and practices before we end this lesson. First, the afterlife. You want to be saved, you need to be a Muslim. None will enter paradise but a Muslim, I quote. We read about a Jewish boy who embraces Islam and therefore escapes hellfire. Hellfire, which is incidentally 70 times as hot as regular fire. Infidels, that is those who do not confess Allah as the only God and Muhammad as his apostle. Infidels are lost, and we may weep for dead infidels who are already being tortured in their graves. There's hellfire, but there's also paradise. And the hadith say that there will be 70,000 in paradise, or maybe 700,000. But after the resurrection, there is the judgment. Muhammad will be the first one to be resurrected. If you're a Christian, you're familiar with 1 Corinthians 15, where we read that Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection. Various men and women came back to life in both testaments, but they would die again. None of them came back with a resurrection body. A full resurrection is exemplified only by Jesus' resurrection from the dead. So the Christian response would be that only Jesus is resurrected and we follow. Yet in Islam, Muhammad is the first. Can you see the competition going on? And yet, even then, it's not consistent, because I found another hadith that says that all will be raised together, all at the same time. I think sometimes maybe Muhammad forgot what he had said. Read about a bridge over the chasm, a bridge for purification of sin. And you've probably heard of this, or you may have seen this in certain movies, even Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. There's a walking over a bridge. You know, it's as thin as a razor. This comes from the Muslim teaching. Narrated Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, Allah's apostle said, when the believers pass safely over the bridge across hell, they will be stopped at a bridge in between hell and paradise, where they will retaliate upon each other for the injustices done among them in the world. And when they get purified of their sins, they will be admitted into paradise. So this idea of the bridge, that's where it comes from. Whether it's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, or Hadith of Bukhari 3, number 620. There's a sense of purification. Something has to happen. Now, grave sins will be forgiven. it seems like most people will make it across as long as there are no instances of shirk or suicide. Shirk, again, associating any other with God, especially saying that God has a son, which is an unforgivable sin. Or suicide, even in great pain, that is unforgivable. And the punishment will be in hell that the action by which the suicide died will be repeated. If you poisoned yourself, presumably you would be poisoned repeatedly. If you fell on your sword, you would be pierced by a sword over and over and over. I asked a prominent Muslim teacher, an imam, when I was producing one of my books, which came out in 2013, the book about heaven and hell, and he gave me permission to say this. Muslims generally believe that good souls will go to heaven and bad souls to hell. But the Quran, this is Surah 746, also mentions a third place, the heights. Various scholarly opinions have been offered as to who will inhabit the heights. Usually these opinions hover around the central idea that some people are not good enough to merit heaven and not bad enough to be consigned to hell. Moreover, from the Quranic description, it is clear that the dwellers of the heights would eventually be admitted to heaven. Heaven is believed to be the abode of eternal bliss in the presence of God. Believers will enjoy seeing God, and they will bask in the knowledge that God is pleased with them. Hell, on the other extreme, holds in store some of the most gruesome tortures imaginable. Most Muslims believe that heaven and hell are everlasting. Some significant Muslim scholars, however, have held the view that hell will have a limited duration. And I was appreciative that Shabir Ali allowed me to share that. So they definitely believe in hellfire, and they believe in heaven, but they don't necessarily believe that everyone's going there. In paradise, the first meal we will have is fish liver. Fish liver. I don't know how I feel about that, but that's what I read in the Hadith. There's tremendous emphasis on hell, far, far more in the Quran and the Hadith than there are in the New Testament, by a huge factor. Yet, despite the emphasis, there seem to be many ways to avoid it. It's not just martyrdom in jihad that gets you instant paradise. You can be martyred, and I put that in quotes, if you die of abdominal disease. It seems that extreme pain counts and somehow purges you. Martyrdom, if you die defending your own property, or if two people testify about you that you have a good character, you go to paradise. A woman who lost three children, think of infant mortality being higher than three of her children died, she's automatically guaranteed a place in paradise. Or you can learn the 99 names of Allah. If you learn them, then you will go to paradise. But don't get your hopes up, because only 0.1% of mankind will be saved. That's 1 in 1,000. That means that only a very few Muslims will make it. I mean, think of it today. In a world population of 7 billion, there must be close to 1.5 billion Muslims. If only 0.1% of mankind makes it, then most Muslims don't make it. And yet this doesn't seem to be the conclusion that most Muslims draw, or at least the ones I talk with. They seem to have a sunnier outlook. Let's look at a couple of other categories of teaching and practice before we end this session. I'll begin with negative and move to positive. On the negative side, no tattoos. Art has to be very simple. You can't portray animals, for example. That's only for the creator to do. No silver utensils or golden rings. Don't enter a house where there's a picture of a living creature. Don't enter a house that has a dog. And in fact, don't even have a dog unless it's a working dog. It has to be doing something useful, like, you know, herding sheep. No alcohol, strictly forbidden, much more clearly so here than in the Quran. Don't carry the Quran into hostile territory, I guess because it could be dishonored. Don't clap, no applause. Clapping is for women. Women do that, men don't do that, don't do it. Punishments. Muhammad orders hands to be cut off a woman for stealing, not a hand, but both hands. If an unmarried man has sexual intercourse, 100 lashes of the whip and 1 year of exile. But usually it seems to be the woman who's getting caught and in trouble. The lascivious slave girl who is lashed, or the times where adulteresses are stoned to death, which cannot help but make Christians think, I believe, of John chapter 8. How did Jesus behave? What did he say when they brought the woman caught in the act of adultery? On the positive side, memorize the Quran. It's not a command, but it's certainly commended. And those who do it, the Hafiz memorizes the entire Quran. He is applauded in a non-literal sense in the Hadith. Free your slaves. At a time of lunar eclipse or solar eclipse, free your slave. Let your slave go. And no cruelty to animals. Rather, kindness. Unpack them if they're standing under a load. Don't make your poor camel be in the hot sun. If you're not, if he doesn't have to be loaded, take the pack off and let him rest. And one somewhat touching story, Muhammad is just drunk from the well, and he sees a dog, his mouth open, its tongue hanging out, and he has compassion on the dog, so maybe he didn't dislike dogs after all. Muhammad goes to the well, climbs in, and he takes off his shoe, fills it up, and lets the dog drink water out of his shoe. However, in my humble opinion, Muhammad was sometimes more compassionate to animals than he was to people. More on this in part 6. But we'll begin our next podcast in part 5 on women and family.